This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Chi. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, how are you both doing this evening?
Oh, well, how about yourself, Nathan?
I'm doing fantastic. Dr. Hawk, we missed you, but we're so glad to have you back.
Oh, it's good to be back.
I forgot about her.
Yes. Reports of my death were greatly exaggerated.
It's great to have you back.
Well, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, we've had a little bit of turmoil in the last, week or so.
Sure.
And so would you, last time you commented on it. And so would you like to say anything else about the current events going on?
Well, I mean, I think first of all, obviously we could talk a little bit more about, Corona, et cetera. But in terms of the current political situation that I think is a very touchy, raw area, I think there's an awful lot of light. In fact, there is tremendous light that evolutionary analysis will shine on this. And actually, Jen Hawk's insights into this are instrumental to seeing clearly. And probably there may be very few people in the world that can actually see through this thing clearly at this point. But we all will be able to when Jen and I dissect this later on. But we're not going to do it in the middle of the war. We're going to do it afterwards when heads are cooler and we can all step back and get a nice objective look and sort of look at our causal analysis of this one brick at a time, very calmly and methodically, and see if we can see our way to some very interesting insights. But until then, just sit tight and it's more productive for us to look at other things.
Yeah.
That makes sense, yeah, Jen, unless you're ready to jump in.
I think that's fair. I have definitely, I've been discussing it with some clients here and there who have been curious. It's definitely come up in some consults, and I've said a few things on the record about it that people can read about. And I'll be making a video or writing about it really very soon on our website. So if people stay tuned at esteemdynamics.com, I'll be publishing something or another there, either just something that I put together or something that both of us put together, because there are obviously a huge number of evolutionary insights and political, bringing it all together in political analysis that I don't see reflected anywhere else in the analytical space. So I think we have some value to contribute. We just want to make sure that we're covering all of our bases and doing a really thorough job. So, but yeah, stay tuned.
Value to a few nerds out there. That's right. That's it.
But that's basically the kind of business that we're in. So.
Yeah. So yeah. That's good. I didn't realize you were ready to think about this soon. But hey, however you want to handle it, we'll do it that way.
I think so. I think I don't want to say next week or anything, but I think it's important. Yeah, like you're saying, we don't want to join the cacophony of voices. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where it's not contributing any sort of academic analysis, but I think we do have important things to add to the conversation. So we don't want to completely take ourselves out of it, but we want to make sure that we're doing a good job.
Yeah. There you go. Political scientist. Itchy. She's got a little itchy finger on the keyboard. That's all good.
Definitely.
Oh my.
Well, right. our listeners and I are patiently waiting for when such a time is the right time to do such an analysis.
All good.
Yeah, agreed.
All right, Nathan, what do we got?
Well, our first question, dear doctors, Looking at a list of the foods with the most AGEs in them, fried or high-temperature cooked high-protein fat sugar foods, it almost seems as if humans can in fact taste these advanced glycation end products specifically. Not just the increased caloric density from removing the water. The caramelization actually tastes better without necessarily making it much lower effort calories. Why should the products of cooked fats and protein, especially in combination with each other and sugar, taste so much better to humans than those same products mildly cooked or uncooked? Cooking fat doesn't make its calories more available or make high-protein meals as proportionally more pleasurable as the increase in calorie density.
Well, you know, here's the problem, that I don't know. And so I don't know, and there's things, a lot of things about nutrition that I don't know. And Jen, do you know the answer to this?
I'm not an expert on this particular topic. I'm not an expert on nutritional topics in general, and I don't know much about AGEs. I've read some things, and I've watched some videos out there in the space, but I personally can't contribute much.
Hmm. Nathan, do you know the answer to this?
You know, I've kind of learned that when I don't know, we got to consult an expert in nutrition. Well, that's typically what I do.
I'm here with my mother. So my mother's not an expert. So I already know she doesn't know. Nathan, you don't know. Jen, can you help us here? Do we have any way to answer this question?
I have a friend who might be able to contribute. Let me see if I can ring him up.
Did someone say expert in nutrition?
Oh my God. Is that Dr.
No.
Michael Greger?
This is Dr. Michael Greger. You just got to rub the lamp and I will pop up to answer any nutrition questions you may ever have.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Very All handy right. to have on call.
Wow, how handy is that? All right, well, Michael, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. I don't know by what kind of magic you're with us, but hey, you're here. That's fantastic.
He
Good
just
to have
told
you.
Us it's a magic lamp. So we have three wishes. We can ask him three questions.
Yeah, you just have to look into a mirror and say broccoli three times in a row, and I pop right up.
And there's no oil in this lamp, I'm assuming, right?
No, definitely not an oil lamp. Nor is it a salt lamp. Oh, my goodness. No Himalayan salt lamps.
Oh. Yeah. Well, Michael, first answer our question for us. What do you have to say?
The question is a little confused. Caramelization is actually a different process. There are a number of different compounds created by high dry heat, starting about 300 degrees Fahrenheit. Caramelization is when you're the pyrolysis of sugars, when you're burning off sugars. But there's these Maillard reaction products, which are created by the combination of dry heat plus sugars plus amino acids as a constituent of protein. And in the late stages, you can create these advanced glycation end products, these AGEs, these so-called glycotoxins, and that's a combination of both lipid, the fat, and sugar, and amino acids. It should be no surprise that we have developed a taste for cooked compounds, because cooking increases food safety, particularly for these kind of products, animal products, as well as improves the digestibility of many other foods. And so developing an attraction to cooked flavor compounds seems to make evolutionary sense to me. Unfortunately, they're not particularly good for you, and that's why I would encourage, one of the reasons why, for example, stewed meat in a soup is healthier than braised or broiled or baked or barbecued.
Aha. Fantastic, yeah, Michael. Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you very much. Hey, Nathan.
Thank you, Dr. Greger.
What do we say we met? Michael, you've been super busy, and obviously you've been I know something about what it takes to put a book together. I've never put a book together of the magnitude of the book that you just published. just give us a feel for kind of what some of your thoughts have been now in these last few months as you've been working on this, and things we ought to be looking for and thinking about.
You mean you haven't written a 600-page book with 3,500 scientific citations in 6 weeks? Slacker!
No, that's not on my bucket list either.
How to Survive a Pandemic, out now in both audiobook and ebook, out in August in physical copies. And of course, all proceeds I get from my books donate directly to charity. Just want to have everyone to have this access to this life-saving information. I think one thing that my book, my contribution adds, which is being really neglected, is the best way to survive a pandemic is really to prevent it in the first place. And so the bulk of the book actually centers around tracing the origins of the COVID coronavirus and what we can do to prevent even greater infectious disease threats in the future. You know, over the last few decades, hundreds of human pathogens have emerged at a rate unprecedented in human history. Say, wait a second, emerged from where? Mostly from animals. The AIDS virus is blamed on the butchering of primates and the bushmeat trade in Africa. Mad cow disease was because we turned cows into carnivores and cannibals. SARS and COVID-19 have been traced back to the exotic wild animal trade. You know, but our last pandemic, swine flu in 2009, arose not from some backwater wet market in Asia, but was largely made in the USA on pig operations in the United States. Now, thankfully, swine flu only killed about 500,000 people, but the next time we might not be so lucky. As difficult as COVID-19 has been, it may just be a dress rehearsal for an even greater threat waiting in the wings of chickens. According to the CDC, the leading candidate for the next pandemic is a bird flu virus known as H7N9, which is 100 times deadlier than COVID-19. Instead of 1 in 250 cases dying, H7N9 has killed 40% of the people it infects. Now, the last time a bird flu virus jumped species directly to humans and caused a pandemic, it triggered the deadliest plague in human history, the 1918 pandemic, which killed upwards of 50 million people. That had a 2% death rate. What if we had a pandemic infecting billions where death was closer to a flip of a coin? But the good news is there's something we can do about it. Just as eliminating the exotic animal trade and live animal markets may go a long way towards preventing the next coronavirus pandemic, reforming the way we raise domestic animals for food may help forestall the next killer flu. The unprecedented emergence of H7N9 and 10 other bird flu viruses newly infecting people around the world has been blamed on industrial poultry production. You know, when we overcrowd thousands of animals and these cramped, filthy football field sized sheds to lie beak to beak or snout to snout atop their own waste, it's just a breeding ground for disease. The sheer numbers of animals, the overcrowding, the stress crippling their immune systems, the ammonia from the decomposing waste burning their lungs, lack of fresh air, lack of sunlight, put all these factors together, and what you have is really a perfect storm environment for the emergence and spread of these so-called super strains of influenza. That's why the American Public Health Association, the largest and oldest association of public health professionals in the world, has called for a moratorium on factory farming. The bottom line is that it's not worth risking the lives of millions of people for the sake of cheaper chicken.
I would think so. Magnificent, Michael. Yeah.
Dr. Greger, thank you so much. I've been reading your, I've been listening and reading your book at the same time. So, and it's quite remarkable. I've learned more than I thought I could about a metamorphosis of viruses and transmissions and, you know, soon to be learning about COVID. So,
yeah. Fabulous. So, Michael, this obviously you didn't cook this up recently. So, this was actually your intellectual focus earlier in your career. Is that correct?
Yeah, the first half of people know me for my work in lifestyle medicine, but first half of my career was in public health, particularly emerging infectious disease. That's most of my peer-reviewed publications in that field. So, yeah, but I was, of course, shouting it from the rooftops along with other public health professionals, completely ignored. Nobody wanted to hear it, but finally, we have this this opportunity where people are paying attention to the risk of pandemic disease. Thankfully, we got off so easy, dodged a bullet with this one. But it was just bad enough to wake people up to the potential of a truly devastating pandemic that may be coming down the pike.
Yeah. Well, this is the notion of sometimes the worst thing that happens is the best thing that could happen. That obviously this was a tragedy for a lot of people and a very expensive process. But maybe, just maybe, we will make some super, super important changes. Fabulous. Thank you. Thanks for that, for helping us. All right, Nathan, what else we got going?
Dr. Greger, thank you so much for coming on. It's just a true honor.
Yeah, we're not kicking him off either. So let us stick around.
Yeah, you can stick around and see if you can chime in on any of these other questions that we have.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, he'll say that the problem is they need to eat better. That's what it is. All right, let's go, Nathan. Let's see what else we got.
All right. Dear doctors, I understand that adopting a whole food plant-based diet is a way of beating our genes that hasn't caught up to our hyper-stimulated modern environment. If we were to continue forward without adopting the diet, wouldn't our genes eventually catch up? Obviously, this does nothing for us in present society and may result in a substantial loss of life, but I'm wondering what that future would look like from an evolutionary perspective.
Well, I'll go ahead and answer this, Jen.
You do a more better job with this one. This is a common question. We actually get a version of this question a lot. And it's, the evolution doesn't work on this kind of time scale.
Right. Evolution also works on a particular problem, which is the statistical increased likelihood of successful reproduction. Right. So it doesn't really care. Quite frankly, evolution doesn't care. Once you're 50, evolution couldn't care less. So the three of you are still alive, but I've been dead for 10 years.
Yeah.
You can just tell by looking at me, I'm an evolutionary dead end. Okay.
Yeah.
So this is the story is that because the food does not wreck people's ability to survive and reproduce, what it does is it wrecks the second half of their life, and through debility and then premature death. So that's what unhealthy habits do, and evolution is not working statistically on that problem. So the answer to the question is no. No, we will remain with the needs of a Stone Age body, and we will remain with a Stone Age brain that actually wants the richest food that it can get. And when we provide it with the kind of food that makes people like Dr. Greger roll their eyes and be frustrated, people are going to continue to circle around heading for that food, and they're going to continue to have the kind of disability and deterioration in later life, but not enough early in life to make any difference on evolution's process at all. So there you have it. That's it. Good question, and move on.
Well, maybe Dr. Greger can comment on, I remember a long time ago, I read an article in Chemical Senses Journal, and they were studying the effect of meat consumption on body odor attractiveness. And it turns out that when they took a bunch of men and they had them wear axillary pads, so collecting their body odor for, a few days. Mm-hmm. And then for the final 24 hours after being 2 weeks on either a non-meat diet and with no alcohol and a meat diet with no alcohol, they found that they actually smelled more attractive to the women who were rating them on several different scales. So
why are you asking Michael this question? You should be asking me this question. Like, can confirm. I've got a large sample size.
Yeah. What's the verdict?
Oh yeah, there's a big difference. At least for my genetic impression is that I find non-meat eating individuals much more sort of attractive interpersonally in that immediate kind of ephemeral pheromone sort of sense. And I'm sure I could replicate it by sniffing t-shirts. Yeah, there's sort of a it's. But I think it probably has a lot to do with the compatibility of the respective microbiomes. I'm not sure that it would be I'm not sure you would see the same effect with vegan women that you would see with meat-eating women. People who sniff a more compatible microbiome similar to their own diet might have more built-in attraction, whereas my microbiome is a little alarmed by a meat-eating diet. So, it's an interesting. There have been several studies that have come to similar results.
Interesting. I didn't know this. Michael, mm-hmm. You must have known this, and this is a secret that you weren't telling.
Of course I know. In fact, I did a video about it.
Competitive edge.
Back in 2007, I did a video on it. Not only are the odor of meat eating odor donors rated as significantly more attractive, more pleasant, but they said that they had a lower perceived body odor hedonicity, meaning pleasure. So vegetarians smell significantly more pleasurable, evidently. Same masculinity, by the way, but less smelly, more pleasant, and significantly judged as more attractive. So the one-liner takeaway, if I remember my video correctly, is that meat is the pits, because it was all sniffing armpit pads.
I'll go ahead and put in here a pitch for nutritionfacts.org, since Michael might not do it on his own behalf. But there's all these there, you know, you see these memes about with Donald Trump, how there's always a tweet. People will go back and dig into the archives and find a tweet that he has issued to describe the current moment or that contradicts the current moment. And with nutritionfacts.org, there's always a video. There's almost nothing that we can talk about that would be idly interest to us that hasn't been documented in pithy video form dating back more than a decade now. So people should avail themselves of all of the information that they can find over there.
Oh, cool.
Wonderful.
Very good.
Dr. Greger, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, thank you.
You bet. Not that this ever helped me get a date. Yeah, all of this promise out of the vegan world about how things are supposed to be so damn rosy. Sure. All right, what else we got, Nathan?
All right, question for the doctors. I have a side gig teaching whole food plant-based nutrition to women in recovery in sober houses in the Boston area. I've been teaching via Zoom these past few weeks. The program was developed by an organization in recovery based on the work of Nathaniel Brandon, Six Elements. And they have merged this approach with plant-based nutrition to develop a specific program around wellness designed to support women in recovery with the knowledge to make better food choices. It also addresses stress management and other wellness topics. The curriculum addresses everything from food addiction and the pleasure trap to stress management, to exercise, to meal planning and recipes. In the groups, which meet weekly for 2 hours over 10 weeks, the women almost always start out extremely cynical. But by the second or third week, I usually have them coming along with me on the ride and opening their minds a bit. Attendance is mandatory, so they have to be in the group. And because of that, I employ a very non-threatening approach, share the science, lots of recipes, how it worked for me personally, etc. There are always some women who are completely close to the concepts, but I focus on those who are curious and want to learn. My question is around the self-esteem content and the best way to integrate the two topics. I'm quite comfortable with the nutrition aspect as I've done some training, but I feel like I could use a deeper understanding of how to support their development of self-esteem given their history of addiction to alcohol or drugs. I'm wondering, number one, how the doctors feel about Dr. Brandon's work. And number two, if they have any specific suggestions for supporting women in recovery with self-esteem. And number three, any thoughts on how to best integrate the two topics?
Well,
I can jump in a little
right
bit.
Ahead,
that
Jen.
We
sure.
Yeah, I'm not as well versed in Nathaniel Brandon as you are, Doug. So you can speak more specifically sure. to him and how, you know, what that approach would look like from this perspective. But as sure. someone who has been in recovery and embraced a whole food plant based diet, I have some things to say about this. And the first is that, you know, people in early recovery, I think I would be very mindful about overloading them with information, and overloading them with, there's sort of this feeling when you're in very early recovery, you're really relearning how to take care of yourself. You're relearning everything about how to live your life. You may have bypassed the whole process of adulting, depending on when you started to use. And you're really kind of stuck in this permanent adolescence when it comes to taking care of yourself, to feeding yourself, to paying your bills, to, you know, practicing good communication in your relationships, like all of these basic things that you miss out on. You miss out on the exposure to those processes if you're deep in an addictive process from a very young age, which most people who get into trouble with recovery do get themselves into. So I remember when I was early in the process, there's just so much literature, there's so much information. And I have the kind of personality with my openness and my conscientiousness particularly I felt I had that drive and that notion that the more information I could get, the better. That if I could better understand myself and better understand how to perfect this recovery thing, then I would put myself in a better position going forward. And it's almost the flip side of the way that you're living your life in addiction is this absolute abdication of responsibility and this sort of removal from sovereignty over your own life. And a lot of people in recovery, it's not just me, I've seen this in all kinds of different recovery programs and in 12-step specifically and in group therapy, there's often this inclination or this turn toward perfectionism among the more conscientious people. So I'm sure it's a beautiful program and it's you're dealing with really important themes, and self-esteem is critically important for these women to understand and to begin mastering. But it's like this is really baby steps at the beginning, and the most important thing is that, you know, they're not picking up or they're not using, and they're learning really basic habits with the whole plant diet to nourish themselves, which, you know, this is like addicts are notorious for just eating absolute crap food. Sometimes to the point where, especially with, you know, pretty advanced alcoholism, it's really all they can keep down, and it's all they can successfully digest or afford or whatever it is. But there's not a lot of people in advanced processes of addiction that are nourishing themselves with good food. So I would just really strip it down to the basics. You know, this is how we cook a really healthy, basic one pot meal that's very starch centered, you know, including some veggies, incorporating some of, you know, Michael's daily dozen recommendations and other, you know, improving as you go, but not trying to overload yourself all at once with getting it too perfect, not letting perfection be the enemy of the good, in other words. So I think that's a really important notion. But for the self-esteem piece, I don't know about Brandon specifically, but I think that this is just beautifully sort of naturally integrated in the one day at a time recovery model that is going to be ascendant in really any recovery program. That you don't want to be looking too far into the future and future tripping about whether you're going to stay sober for the rest of your life. You're dealing with the process of today, and you're building your self-esteem with the feedback that comes from your internal audience from doing a really good job today, whatever that looks like within the program. So it's making yourself 3 square meals of really nourishing starch-based food a day. It's getting yourself out for a walk in some sunshine, spending some time with friends, social distancing permitting, just engaging in those sort of basic techniques of what we might call, for lack of a better word, just kind of self-care and just parenting yourself and learning how to adult, and having a system for that your internal audience is able to kind of check off as you accomplish those goals every day, and give you the feedback as you slowly improve your daily existence through just learning how to take basic care of yourself. That's generally how I would approach it, with mindfulness too, that your brain is the primary thing that is in recovery. You know, I tell people all the time that for me, it wasn't until about the 3rd year of sobriety that I felt like somebody turned the lights on in the room. And cognitively, I was able to integrate a lot more information than I could for those first couple of years. It's really, you've done a number on yourself physically and mentally, and depending on the program, spiritually and emotionally as well. So you really got it. You have to give yourself a lot of time and a lot of compassion while you crawl your way out of that. So very slowly, one day at a time, one good square meal at a time, I think is the way to approach that.
Fabulous. Excellent. I want to comment on a couple things. The this has to do with what Jen wasn't addressing, which is the issues of Nathaniel Brannan's approach. Nathaniel Brannan was a forerunner in thinking about self-esteem, and much of what he said was right on target and is consistent with the way that I think about it. However, there's also large components of his thinking. He was, as much as he wouldn't have wanted to be, he was also a product of the mid-20th century. And as a result, he's very steeped in psychodynamic thought. Now, he himself in his writings would say that he had rejected both psychoanalysis and behaviorism, but it turns out that he didn't really do that. And so he didn't have the conceptual understanding that we have about the primacy of genetics and personality. And he would have thought there's this thing called self-esteem that can be damaged in your youth and that you have permanent scars and that we need to go back into childhood and think through relationships with your parents and possibly siblings and family dynamics, etc., and hurts from past relationships. And that essentially that process needs to be essentially resurrected and examined and needs to be sort of healed. This is incorrect. And so the program, to the extent that it emphasizes the components of Brannan's thinking, that you have essentially emotional repression that is now unconsciously buried, that is causing you to do self-destructive processes, this is a fundamental mistake. And so what we want to do is we want to take the positive notions of Brannan, which are consistent with what we talk about, which is that self-esteem is actually a process where our internal audience observes us making excellent efforts and then gives us feedback that is positive about that. Okay, the Brannan will when you do things poorly and you actually have internally negative reverberations about that. That is not coming from your history and a damage to your nervous system. In fact, what that's coming from is that's coming from either an innately hyper-conscientious internal audience, or it's coming from a completely reasonable internal audience that has observed mediocre execution of behavior. Okay, so that. This seems a little technical and a little overly detailed. Our website will be updated very soon, and there will be a detailed explanation of how self-esteem processes work. They're actually not super complicated, but they are actually quite different than the common status quo in thinking about self-esteem, and that includes Brannan. So I would give Brannan an A in some arenas and an F in others, and so our job now is to take the A work from his thinking and minimize in your program anything that has to do with ancient history, childhood, or any other thing, because that's a waste of time and it's a red herring and it's actually counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawke, I noticed that in my life is that, you know, when my self-esteem mechanism is working appropriately, I'm more agreeable. I feel more stable. I feel like I just feel like my personality is just a tad bit more conducive to life. Mm-hmm. And it's incredible as I've watched this happen. And so my question is how do we really know what somebody's personality is until we actually get them to the point where they are proud of themselves and their self-esteem mechanism is full power?
Go ahead, Jen, you can chime in.
Oh, I'll let you continue on that if you're to tie it in with the Brannan stuff.
Yeah, well, I think the truth of the matter is that your personality didn't change that much. You're just the same person that is in better circumstances. So if we looked at across the Big Five or any other way of measuring personality, we see that nothing has changed. You're essentially the same cat, but we put you with a new owner that's better, okay? And so when you're under better circumstances, then your whole life is better. And so you're going to be, for example, you're probably like going to be more stable. You're probably going to be more agreeable, et cetera. And so you get to sleep better at night. So you take anybody and you put them under various stressors, and their functioning is going to look a little different than when they're not as stressed. And self-esteem, when we have there's a reason why Alan gave the Pleasure Trap the tagline, "Mastering the Hidden Force That Undermines Health and Happiness." That was not grandiose. That was very carefully thought through. That the Pleasure Trap is a hidden force. It's hidden because it's not understood. It's completely unnatural to all species to have anything called the Pleasure Trap. Pleasure Trap is specifically artificial process stimulation that will cause the individual to be self-destructive because it's trapping a motivational system that was built for another purpose. And so it is the hidden force that undermines both health, which we all know, but happiness. And a huge way that it undermines happiness is that when you're in the throes of addiction, you know you're doing counterproductive things, that you're wrecking your existence, but you have an extremely difficult time not doing it, no matter how intelligent and conscientious you are. And so, and what happens is the internal audience watches this process and is just befuddled and disgusted and everything else under the sun. So as a result, there's a lot of negative feedback that's coming legitimately from the internal audience as it observes the self-destruct behind the Pleasure Trap. Okay, and also that you're going to find the ego trap. The self is going to look at the internal audience's expectations and say, well, the hell with this, I quit. I'm just going to go drink or whatever else it is going to be. Or just I'm going to go eat, you know, a big chunk of chocolate cake, forget it. It's both the ego trap and the Pleasure Trap are a twin set of snakes that are really out to wipe out, you know, are very potent when it comes to trying to get people on any kind of healthy groove in the face of the Pleasure Trap or any kind of challenge of that magnitude. The reason why I'm speaking at length and to this individual's question is that any attempt to have a program that is trying to address these things and is trying to include what they believe is a comprehensive perspective, which would include childhood pain, adverse childhood events, experiences, et cetera, that have done damage to the quote self-esteem. This is actually fundamentally right at its root wrong. And it's actually a destructive process, I believe. I can't prove that scientifically, but it's obvious. When you have people spending a great deal of time and energy suffering and moping and reanalyzing and digging in the wrong place for the treasure, they're not going to be as effective as if they know just where to look. Where we want to look is in the nature of how the self-esteem mechanism works. And when we work there and when we put our lever in the right place, we can start to move the person's world. Okay. And they very well may look like they have, quote, personality changes secondary to that. But really, we've just put that same personality under better circumstances, i.e., we've increased the person's effectiveness and their happiness.
Wow. Thank you. My grandmother used to tell me, she says, 25% of what you eat is for yourself and 75% is for your doctor. And so I wonder if 25% of what you say to a psychologist is for you and 75% is for them.
Oh, totally. Oh, yeah, traditional psychodynamic therapy, absolutely. And I I've talked about this before, but I have this unique perspective coming out of early recovery and seeking out I was looking under every rock for a psychodynamic explanation of my troubles that I could find. Everywhere except, oh, I have a genetic predisposition to alcoholism, and, you know, the way out is to stoke the self-esteem process and to start feeling proud of myself and pride in my own life and my progress toward competitive goals, which has to start off really, really small when you're coming out of deep addiction. Like, this is a moving target. You're not coming out of a decade of major addiction and immediately setting those competitive goals at the same level that they're going to be in another 10 years. It's a iterative process as you learn to trust yourself. You build more self-efficacy, and you just get healthier, and your brain rebuilds itself over that period of time. So it's a huge process for people, and it's incredibly incredibly difficult for people to go through. And so it's great that you're offering this program for these women who are going through this, but we don't want to completely take them off the path by giving them these excuses and these childhood stories that are, like Doug is saying, put them in the wrong direction in their own self-improvement and their eventual competitive success.
Yeah, mm-hmm. This is good, though. This is like one of the better approaches that I've heard. And
yeah.
I think it's excellent. I think it just probably needs a little bit of pruning and a little bit of direction from what we do with Esteem Dynamics. And they probably have, something that could be very potent. Excellent.
Now, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk, I remember hearing from somebody that they went to not this particular type of seminar, but it was mm-hmm. a seminar, and there was they were trying to do this, this type of let's go back and look at your childhood trauma and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And there was part of the group didn't want to do that, mm-hmm. and part of the group just wanted nothing. Just wanted to do nothing but that. So mm-hmm. what would you say to a facilitator like this asking us the question about the people who, they want to focus on that and that's all they want to do and they get quite disagreeable about it?
Well,
they're watching bell curves in action. I mean, you're gonna find that everywhere.
Yeah, the problem is that this is going to be heart and soul about what Jen and I will be talking about in detail over the next few years. This is the biggest single mistake sitting in the middle of a personal transformation, any kind of therapeutic process, etc. Is this is the biggest fundamental mistake, and so there are reasons why. As Jen would put, there are fascinating perverse incentives that make this continually popular, despite the fact that it is fundamentally self-destructive. But that's okay. We'll get to it. We will explain and we will understand. And hopefully, when we're all through, the world will be a little bit brighter as a result of having light been shown on this problem.
And as a provider, cool. if you're leading a workshop, you're going to you're guaranteed to have that that distribution of responses in any class that you have. So any group of people, you're going to have some people who are more resonant with, what we call the source code of evolutionary psychology and the truth of taking responsibility for your life, and others who are more resistant to it and who want to stay mired in the muck. That's just going to play out in any large group that is up to anything in the world. So that is very much you're not in the business of making those people who want to stay stuck in the muck feel good about that. you're in the business of giving them the truth and giving them the tools that are going to be most effective for them making really meaningful change in their lives. So you don't have to be shitty about it, but you want to be in enough of a position of power in your workshop or in your training program where you don't have to kind of surrender and kowtow to the demands of disagreeable people who want to stay mired in those stories and who are really resistant to hearing the truth about their process. So that's just sort of an overarching principle that can ensure and protect you from having to accommodate that sort of that particular strain of personality cancer.
yeah, and Jen and I would be the first to say that an awful lot of people that are naively interested in trying to figure out the root and have a lot of self-esteem chaos basically echoing through their nervous system and are confused. And if you're being told that the reasons are because you were a victim 28 years ago, it's just, experts are telling you, and that's what the whole world says. It's an echo chamber of ignorance. And so as a result, we're going to be kind but firm as we understand that the truth is different than that. And essentially try to direct people clinically to something that's going to be much more useful. All right.
We got one more question.
Okay.
Dear doctors, I'm a 30-year-old junior doctor and longtime fan of the show. I'm highly conscientious, fairly introverted, open, agreeable, and a bit unstable. In my short life, I have been a metalhead drummer, a skateboarder, have studied classical piano and physics, and am now a doctor. I have spent countless hours on each of these pursuits. I have at times been very happy and lucky in love, and at other times miserable and alone. In my early 20s, I suffered a terrible 2-year-long depressive episode that I was only able to escape by completely overhauling my life with a major shift in values and a new single-minded focus on making intelligent decisions and working hard to slowly improve my happiness over many years. I reoriented my life away from exploration, joy, and growth towards basically doing everything I can to make sure I don't get depressed again. I decided to enter medicine in order to have a high-paying, high-status, dependable job, even though it meant 5-6 years of living on a very low income studying something that I actually find quite boring. Unfortunately, I have now been finding it increasingly difficult to relate to the people around me, and I've been floundering in social situations both at work and outside work. I don't have a relaxed, easygoing attitude, and I can't fake it any longer. I also have been single for 2 years and now have few remaining close friends. I think this is partly because I have lived a pretty extreme life and have pushed myself very hard through some tough situations, which makes it hard to relate to others, but also because I'm fairly extreme in openness and conscientiousness department. What advice do you have for improving my social situation? I know Dr. Lyle recommends fishing where the fish are, but I'm struggling to find my fish.
Well, what do you feel like, Jen?
Let's see. So I would say this sounds like a very rarefied personality type. So you've got an extreme mm-hmm. personality type, which is just who you are. So you've had this, you know, crazy history of all of these different experiences, and it has cost you some social connections, and it's made it more difficult to find people to connect with. And that's just what it is. So we can't change who you are. We can't change what drives you and what kind of relationships you're seeking. And so the fish where you fish are metaphor is sort of like, you just have to, I hate to expand upon such a non-vegan metaphor. It's like, yeah. You just have to, it's a numbers game. If you've got a very rare personality, that just means that you have to expose yourself to that many more potential candidates for coalition than somebody with a more average personality or an easier personality to find coalition members. So this is going to apply to people with all kinds of distortion in their big five. Just as the more difficult it is for you to find similarly built humans who are going to enjoy the same kind of things that you are and who are going to see in you a valuable insurance policy that is represented by their friendship, by your friendship with them, which is what friendship really is. If you've got to be providing value to them just like they have to be providing value to you. And, you know, useful to each other when things go poorly in the future, if they do. And so in your case, with the sort of personality type that you have, it's going to be tougher. It's going to be tougher to find those people. They're out there, just like you're out there. But it's a matter of exposing yourself to greater numbers of people who don't qualify for coalition and getting more discerning about, you know, moving quickly on from those people once you rule them out of coalition candidacy and just hoping that the lords of fate bestow you with people who do qualify for coalition and then nurturing those connections when and if you do find them. And they're rare. You know, I have an unusual personality. I don't think it's as distorted on the dimensions that you're talking about, but it is distorted on several. And it's been difficult for me to find people who qualify for coalition, but I stumble across them once in a while. But I'm also extroverted enough that I talk to a lot of people and I vet a lot of people for potential friendship and coalition that ultimately don't make the cut. And so you have to just kind of embrace that process and hope that you get lucky would be the way that I would look at that with friendship, with romance, and with anything else.
And then when Jen had good things happen, then she dumps her friends at Beat Your Jeans. That's what happens.
Says my number one coalition member.
All right. Now, I want to add a few things. This is just beautiful. All right on. I would say this, that I hear something interesting happening, and that is that the person had a major depressive process, and they're a little intimidated about that because it's a little bit mysterious. And they found that by getting productive and having some kind of moving forward, that they got happy again. So let's talk just very briefly, so we understand clearly what happiness and depression are. This is sort of a cleaver of a continuum of the qualitative feeling of emotional experience. And of course, those qualitative feelings are actually nothing other than analogs for the underlying probabilities of gene survival that are sitting under those experiences. So obviously, an orgasm under the right conditions with the right person should be about as good as it gets for human beings, which we would expect that it would be, because that's how the genes are going to get reproduced. And those would be the genes that you would want to be reproduced. On the other hand, being tortured or some other such thing, when you're about to die, that's about the worst thing. So the feelings are an analog map of gene survival probabilities. And so therefore, depression is it may be mysterious to this individual, but it's actually not mysterious at all. If we were to analyze it from this perspective, we would realize that the depression was failure feedback. And so knowing that depression is simply failure feedback, and understanding that we don't have to work frenetically to avoid failure feedback, we just have to understand the nature of that feedback and then map our way around that failure, you know, domain more effectively. And so success leaves clues in those arenas, and so we have to just be smart about that. And it sounds to me like this person has not had any serious trouble in many years, and we wouldn't expect them to ever have trouble again. What Jen was talking about was you could think about life as a giant smorgasbord of people. So in that smorgasbord, your happiness is dependent upon, are you going and getting, you know, really good food that you like repeatedly? That's what it's going to be. And so there's going to be a certain amount of novelty that's necessary. You're not going to want to just have brown rice and broccoli every day of your life, even though it might be adequate at some times. So you're going to want to have some novelty, but you're in order to get the novelty and get your coalition to meet a lot of your different potentials for activating your moods of happiness, there's going to be some trial and error and inevitable short-term failure. That's the way it works. We look at this life. This is a young person, but life is really a process of, it's a journey of self-discovery, and that means, that sounds highfalutin, but it's not meant to be. It's essentially, you've got a personality or a genetic characteristics that your preferences fundamentally will never change. The job is to figure out, it's basically like a pinball game, that if we know where the points are scored and how to do it, then we can hit those circuits more often and more completely and have greater life satisfaction. It's not fundamentally that hard. Very often when we're unhappy and we're frustrated, the answers are not that far from the surface. They are in relationships that are causing us difficulty. In this case, the person's not very happy about their work. They have done a tremendous job in putting themselves in a position where they can be financially flexible. So go find components within that career that are exciting. Or if they're not, you can always work that career part-time. And if you desperately want to paint and be a Van Gogh, then you can do it, because you can work 2 days a week and spend the other 5 days a week as Van Gogh, if that's what you want to do. So your nervous system leaves you clues. Just as success always leaves clues anywhere in the marketplace, it also leaves clues inside. You've had experiences of happiness. There's a pattern to those. Find out where to spend your time and energy, where it hits those circuits and scores those points. We shouldn't have to live this life the slightest bit with other than short-term discomfort, given the hand that this person has. There's all kinds of people and all kinds of really interesting and exciting things to do.
Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, and Dr. Greger, thank you so, so much for joining us this evening and for answering these questions for us and enlightening us to some of the secrets of beating our genes.
Very good. Thank you, Nathan. Thank you, Michael, for sharing this hour with us.
Honored to be on anytime.
Guys, all have a good night.
I gotta say one more thing, just for people that now have maybe heard Michael for the first time. That there's the thing that any people that do any speaking in the world in the arenas where Michael speaks, we all know something about this, and that is, you don't want to go in front of Michael, and you definitely don't want to go behind Michael. You don't want to look bad, because you're going to if you're anywhere there. So it's a joy to have you with us, Michael, but let's make sure that I never have to speak in front or behind you. Let's just keep a little distance for me. But thanks for coming.
I would just be happy to be back speaking at a conference, period.
Oh, that's true. Actual real live event.
You got it.
Yeah. Well, for anybody who wants to learn more about Dr. Greger's work, you can visit nutritionfacts.org. And he's got several books out, the most recent of which is called How to Survive a Pandemic. And other books are How Not to Die, How Not to Diet, and others. And one of my favorite videos of Dr. Greger's was Uprooting the Leading Causes of Death. I think I've sent that one to more people than I know. So, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, Dr. Greger especially, have a wonderful, wonderful night, and we'll look forward to hearing from you again very soon.
Thank you, Nathan. Have a good one. All right, good night.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.